I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
That's great, lady.
But you're a cop!
He's got my old badge, Sanchez. He's running around playing cop, assaulting and beating people. Police! Drop the gun, son.
An anonymous, apparently off-duty police officer interrupted a robbery tonight, heroically confronting an armed robber with only bottles of spaghetti sauce.
I used to rob people who robbed people.
Kind of like Robin Hood?
Yeah. Except I didn't give the money to the poor people.
Hey there, and welcome to Rewatchability. My name is Blaine Waters, and with me, as always, is
Robert Larone, Jr.
Oh, you snuck it in there.
Yes. You can't stop me.
And joining us is Norm Wilner, a Now Magazine critic. You have your own podcast.
I do. As well. Yeah, Someone Else's Movie, newly joined to the Frequency Podcast Network, which is why I'm doing this charm tour of the world, apparently.
You're here to steal our listeners.
I'm here to absorb them.
Oh. Yeah.
You can keep them, but I'll assimilate them.
There's room for two podcasts.
Be charmed, listeners. Be charmed.
It's a whole corporate thing.
Well, thanks so much for joining. It's great.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
And we talked to you before about coming on the podcast, and you were like, I don't see Miami Blues on your roster.
Yeah.
And that's because we had never seen Miami Blues.
Or heard of it.
This is a – yeah. Really? It wasn't a movie that kind of
– You can say it. Happened.
I mean, it happened.
It happened. There's evidence of it. But we're of like a younger generation, I think. So I think like this would have come out when I was 6.
Right.
So sometimes these movies we just sort of miss.
Yeah.
Okay, no.
Yeah. My mom didn't take me to see this one. But but she would have. I think she was a fan of Alec Baldwin, you know?
Yeah. And the early, you know, the
yeah,
young,
he was pretty
young, sleek.
Yeah.
Otter-like Alec Baldwin.
He kind of looks like Ryan Gosling.
Oh, my God. I was thinking the same thing.
Yeah. Like, I can see why they both came like big stars. They're
he
like
has
really
a Gosling-esque quality.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Well, it's the sense that he's vulnerable but violent. Right? Like this particular
like
performance
Drive.
Really has that Drive or even Blue Valentine where he's not – like it's not an action movie in any way but he still carries that volatility.
Like that seething. Yeah.
And Baldwin was doing stuff like that in comic roles in Married to the Mob, the Jonathan Demme film, and he sort of plays that role. This would have been just the year after that.
Yeah. Which is why they're working together again, Jonathan Demme
Demme produced this for a friend of his and it's very clearly influenced by – Demme's thing, but it
definitely.
Is also its own. I mean, I'm kind of amazed that – I'm not amazed you haven't seen it. I totally understand this.
Yeah,
it's under the radar. But I love the idea that you're coming to it for the first time now, like almost 30 years later.
Yeah. Well, and that's why it's exciting to do. And it's always exciting to find movies that weren't on our radar and that have so much like interesting things going on, so much to talk about in it. So I can't wait to get to that.
Yeah.
But before we get to that, I want to thank our Patreon listeners. Thank you so much for going to patreon.com/rewatchability and giving us $1, $3, or $5 a month to keep the podcast going. And you get the podcast early and ad-free, which is pretty sweet.
Mm-hmm.
And you get some bonus episodes every once in a while. And you're staring at me waiting for the – all right. So let's get into the movie. Both of us haven't seen this movie, so why don't we go to you, Norm. When did you first see this movie and like how did it affect you at the time?
I saw it on opening day.
Yeah?
It would have been this No, not even the spring. It was like January or February of 1990.
Okay. Did you sleep out overnight Star Wars style?
We didn't do that then. Oh, we just – movies opened in five or six theaters and you were – if you were not in school, you went like Friday 1:30. It's like, oh, I know these people involved. I want to see this movie.
Yeah.
I was familiar with the books that it's based on, a series of novels by Charles Williford with these great Florida noir stories of a cop named Hoke Mosley and his general – I guess you could call it competence. He's not the most he's not the most polished detective.
No, right.
And Fred Ward in the film just captures that perfectly. They were actually going to do they were going to do a television series for Amazon, I think, with Paul Giamatti, and it fell apart. But you could see that
there's
a continuity there.
Yeah, yeah. Giamatti wouldn't lose his teeth.
Right. He'd get him knocked out though. Like he'd lose them in a fight. It would be it would be like the opening scene.
Yeah, for sure.
Or the show.
Think about it, Giamatti.
Yeah. But it was one of those movies that had almost no marketing. Orion Pictures was doing pretty well.
Right.
But they were constantly in financial trouble. They were overextending themselves. So here they were sub-distributed by MGM, I think, and they just didn't put anything behind it. There were newspaper ads and you knew it was coming.
Yeah.
But that was it.
Right. The box office was like, no, it didn't do well. There was no advertising.
Barely got released in the States, barely opened in Canada. But I saw it, I want to say, three times during its theatrical run.
Wow.
I loved it.
What captured you about it?
Looking back now, it's easier to put into perspective. It feels like the other direction that noir movies might have taken if Tarantino hadn't come along.
Right.
Because Reservoir Dogs shows up at Sundance in 92 and just obliterates everything else. It reinvents the genre. This one was different. This one was another kind of character-based rather than plot-based. It felt a lot like the crime dramas of the 70s and
80s. Yeah, for sure.
But without the slickness, without the production values that were starting to creep in.
Yeah, it felt a lot like Fletch.
Yeah,
honestly,
it's got a lot of shagginess to it that way. The framing is big and friendly. You get to see things happening sometimes before the characters do.
Yeah, so it's not like overtly stylized or anything. Mm-hmm. There's no big camera movements or anything. It's just kind of showing you what's happening.
Yeah, yeah. And the Blu-ray that's out now from Shout Factory has a transfer that is incredibly faithful. It looks like crap. It doesn't look – there's not a lot of extra – smoothening done. There's no DNR.
Right.
There's none of the tricks that you use to make a film look more contemporary. It looked like that then. It looked like it was being projected through grindhouse filters.
Okay.
And it's kind of great for that. There's a sense of, if not reality, then a sort of a grimy authenticity to the world.
Mm.
And you can believe these people are operating in this world without ever really getting larger attention.
Yeah.
That Junior Frenger could leave prison, go back to Florida, kill a couple of people along the way and just show up and reinvent himself because it's 1990 and nobody has any access to anything.
Yeah.
The information comes when it comes.
Mm-hmm.
It's relayed by phone calls and by people showing up at people's doors. I mean, it would not work now.
Yeah. And it's very much like a book, like it came from.
Yeah. So. Well, it's got an Elmore Leonard-y kind of vibe. Charles Williford worked in that vein too where he was much more interested in dialogue and character than he was in plots.
Mm-hmm.
There's another book called New Hope for the Dead, which is just – again, if nobody out there knows this, go read this book. It's fantastic. It's amazing no one has made a movie out of it.
Is that the fourth book in the series,
New
Hope for the Dead?
Might have been the third.
Okay.
But it could have been.
Yeah.
He would have gone on much, much longer, but unfortunately he didn't.
Yeah, 88 he died, right?
Yeah.
He didn't even get to see this movie.
No, the film's dedicated to him.
Yeah.
I think he did work on the development of it. I suspect he was involved in it. But the director is George Armitage, who's a guy who made Rolling Vengeance, I could be Rolling Thunder. I always mix these up. I'm so sorry. I will quietly double check
I think
check
it's Rolling
this.
Thunder, but –
Was it Rolling?
I think
There's one where Willem Devane has a hook for a hand.
Okay.
There's one with a truck.
Okay.
And he directed one of them because I'm so tired today that I can't actually remember which one is which.
No worries.
He directed that. He was part of the Roger Corman exploitation crew that came up in the 60s and 70s. He made a nurses movie too.
Okay.
I think it's The Young Nurses
in
1971.
Yeah.
And it turns out I have that, which I was delighted to find. It was on this box of Shout Factory has been doing the Roger Corman stuff for years and years and years. And there's a DVD box set of all the nurses. And they sent it to me back when I was reviewing movies for the Toronto Star, I think it must have been. And I was the video writer and they sent me everything. And I found out that I have this lost George Armitage movie. They released it once and never came back. And I still haven't seen it. But
Jesus.
I'm kind of on a kick now.
How many – do you keep all those old – because you've been a critic for a long while. And do you keep all those old videos you get sent? The DVDs and the VHS?
A lot of them. Yeah, yeah. I still have laser discs from way back when. Stuff that stuff that isn't available elsewhere. Like the Criterion edition of Cronenberg's Crash has a commentary track that never resurfaced, so I kept it.
Wow.
Laser disc will come back.
Yeah, they shouldn't.
They'll be the next thing, millennials.
Yeah. It's true. It's rarer than rare, right? Like laser discs are the vinyl of the VHS.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
They are better. They still look like garbage now, though. That's the whole problem with HD.
Were you drawn to like the character in particular, or was it just kind of the world and the way it was filmed, or was there anything?
The hook for me was the execution.
Yeah.
It was the idea that you could start a movie called Miami Blues, which is about a criminal and a cop, with Spirit in the Sky, which at the time, like, that was a song that had disappeared into obscurity. I know it's on the Guardians of the Galaxy soundtrack now.
Right. Yeah.
But those notes kind of pounding into the movie at the very beginning where you have no idea what kind of movie it is.
Right.
The aesthetic
had you seen like a trailer
revealed.
At all?
I don't think I had, actually.
Okay. So you went into this totally blind.
Yeah, I knew the book, but that was it.
Right.
And again, you have no idea how it's going to be executed. Maybe it's going to be super grim. I mean, this is a movie about a guy who kills people.
Right. But it isn't grim. It's like so bright.
No,
the
it's
entire,
almost joyful.
Yeah. I don't think there's a scene at night.
There's the scene in the 7-Eleven, the scene in the convenience store.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's about it.
I think
though.
That's it.
Oh, and the scene where he goes and beats up Hoke.
Yeah, like one or two scenes, but the rest is like bright Miami sunshine.
Right.
And yeah.
It's all yellows and pinks and everybody's wearing pastels.
Yeah, I know. It's like an Easter parade.
It's hideous. But it's actually part of it, right? Because, I mean, you've got that water ballet sequence where everything is just absurdly pretty in a way that it doesn't belong. And that Baldwin's character is just this interloper who shows up and starts taking things. I mean, that's his whole thing, right? I can have anything I want, but I don't know what I have.
Yeah. Right,
I don't know what I want. I blew it. I blew the line. But it is such a pleasurable film in a lot of the same ways that Reservoir Dogs is. Like, it makes you appreciate what you like about the genre. It makes you enjoy bad people being bad and good people being incompetent.
Right.
You're encouraged to take pleasure and identify with them, and then of course you're forced to confront the awfulness, the true gravity of what they've done and the damage they do to people.
For sure,
yeah. And that happens pretty quickly
with
Jennifer Jason Leigh's character. But you're still the smartest thing about the film is that it puts us in her position. She is afraid of Freddie. This is this is a young woman, 23-year-old Susie Wagner, who meets Baldwin's character, Freddie, who's calling himself Herman Gottlieb, Junior Gottlieb, which is a great joke, in a hotel in Miami. He's just arrived. He wants a girl. She gets sent up to his room, and he decides that he's in love with her and that she should live with him.
Mm-hmm.
And from the jump, her character is sort of a naive person. She's not terribly bright, but she gets him right away. The great thing about this film still now, I just watched it again last week, is that all three characters see the others for who they are. There's no illusions. Everybody's lying about something. Hoke is pretending he's not investigating something when he first meets him, and then he sort of keeps up this pretense of being a shambling idiot.
Yeah.
Susie is pretending to be a 19-year-old hooker who's worldly wise and street smart, and Junior is pretending to be what does he call himself? Some kind of solid citizen.
Right, yeah.
And it's blatantly obvious to us and to all of them that none of them is that thing.
Right,
that
they're all lying to each other, but all of them see through it at the same time.
And the only person who is smart enough to hope for a better outcome is Susie, who wants Junior to be better.
That's a nice way of putting it, because when I – we're going to get to the rundown in just a second. But when I saw it, I was like, oh, it's too bad that she's so naive that she can't – but I like that viewpoint, that she's smart enough to hope.
Yeah, and she's the only person in the movie who wants to see the best in him.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, he doesn't even want to see the best in himself.
No, and he can't handle it.
Yeah.
Ultimately, I think that's the reason he destroys himself. He destroys their relationship because he just he can't be the person she needs him to be.
There's I forget the name of it, but a Coen Brothers movie that has the same kind of criminal character Nick Cage plays.
Raising Arizona?
Raising Arizona has that kind of same criminal character. I love that movie so much.
Obscure Coen Brothers.
You wouldn't even heard of it yet.
Yeah, I'm thinking like No Country to Stand.
but he wants so badly to be good for his wife, and he cannot be.
But the genius of Raising Arizona, though, is that all of his skills as a criminal become essential to their goal.
Right.
Their shared goal,
yes.
Which is why it's a comedy and why Miami Blues is a tragedy.
Yeah. Miami Blues is definitely a tragedy for sure. Well, let's get into the rundown. Rob, do you want to tell our listeners kind of what this movie is about if they haven't seen it?
Yes, I will try to. I mean, it starts with Alec Baldwin. We don't know who he is or what he is, but he is on a plane. He's flying in. He seems like fascinated with, you know, whatever's outside the window. He looks like a child, you know, peeking outside the porthole.
Yeah, exactly.
Or whatever it is.
On the soundstage.
Yeah. We sort of see, like, he's practicing somebody else's handwriting. Yeah. There's something sketchy about him. He picks up somebody else's briefcase.
Right.
Or a suitcase.
Suitcase is a woman's suitcase.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is why, first of all, if you're a criminal, go for a man's suitcase. Those clothes are going to probably fit you a little bit better than the woman's suitcase in 1990s Miami. I don't know.
He tries.
Yeah.
He does try.
Yeah.
I mean, we see him approach a couple of business guys, and they turn towards him, and he just pivots away. It's this great shark-like action on Baldwin's part. He is
always
there to
forward.
Take things and not stop.
Without hesitation or reservation.
Mm-hmm. Gives the kid a little candy, takes his mom's suitcase.
Yeah.
Kid has candy. Nobody got hurt. Like that seems to be his motif, right? And then gradually we find out he's not actually benevolent.
Yeah, because I wanted to like him so much in the beginning because you want to like the criminal in a way in a movie. You want to like the con man or the rapscallion because they're the underdog. But like very quickly, like I can't like this person at all.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, he breaks Hare Krishna's finger.
Yeah.
And that is sort of what causes the whole plot to begin to roll because that Hare Krishna dies.
From shock.
From shock. And soon they have to investigate this murder. And so we meet the cop who is Hoke.
Mosley.
Who is played by Fred Ward.
What a name, Hoke.
Yeah.
And this is like a grizzled old veteran of the police force. This is not like today's cops. They're all pretty boys and, you know, they have all of their teeth. This is like an old dude. This is like your dad sort of cop, like
for
tough,
sure.
Doesn't share his feelings.
Well, this is played by a 47-year-old Fred Ward who looks like he's about 1,000.
Yeah.
Oh, man. It's like
Hoke has lived hard. I mean, the fact that he puts his dentures in bourbon at the end of every night kind of tells you how he lives.
Wait a minute. Krishna died of a broken finger. I mean, is that a homicide?
Well, I guess he died of shock.
Well, it hurts like hell, that finger bent back. My sister used to do it to me when I was a kid.
Yeah, but you didn't die. Now, if this was an accident, it'd be simple assault, right? However, if the guy in the suede sport coat knew Krishna's had a bad habit of dying every time you bent their finger back.
Murdered one.
Yeah.
But also, like, this is, what, 2 weeks, I think, after Tremors had come out? It was right around the same time, and he's playing a mentor character to Kevin Bacon in that, but still kind of younger anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a jarring, like, oh, that's what a character actor is. You
right.
can do any of these things.
Yeah.
He was Gus Grissom in The Right Stuff in 83. And
it's so funny because I don't see him as a character actor because he doesn't lose himself in a role. It's like, well, with that face, that's Fred Ward.
Yeah, you know? That's like, the quality, right? That's the reason you cast him.
Yeah,
that's
the
character.
Yeah,
you know, this guy, but he's a cop. This guy, but he's an astronaut. This guy, but he's fighting giant
graboids. And he does pivot like a little bit just to kind of lean into the role a little bit.
But, oh, yeah.
Yeah. So he's great. I like him in this movie.
He's the one with the least to do, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he basically just has to get angry and get sad. But he does those variations of it, that dinner sequence that starts the second act of the film where all three characters are in the same place for the first time. He is, you know, he's not doing anything challenging. Everybody else is doing harder stuff, but he holds that center so well, joking around about how, oh, you know, maybe you want to get in the lineup for me and just we know who this guy is and so do they. But he brings this lived quality to it. Like, this is not the first time he's done any of this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's very confident as an actor in this role for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So, the investigation kind of begins at that point where the Hare Krishna gets his finger broken.
Yeah, that's right. And he also has his partner in the sort of craggly-faced
Charles Napier.
Oh, that guy is like classic.
Yeah.
Everybody knows Charles Napier. He's part of the Jonathan Demme repertory company. Like a year later, he's the guy who gets disemboweled in Silence of the Lambs.
Right,
it's his body that gets strung up.
Yeah, right.
And it's just all that stuff. stuff of these familiar, friendly people who you like seeing in other movies. And, oh, look, they're here. They're, this guy's in this. This movie is filled with that guy.
It's great. It's great. And another familiar face in Jennifer Jason Leigh, who Alec Baldwin, as you said, calls down. She's a prostitute.
Yep. Send up a girl.
And they end up getting engaged and having, like, this romance.
Oh, man, this is the part where, like, I really hated him. He's so cruel to her right off the bat. And then there's that little hint of vulnerability that he gives. He's like, you know, lie on your front. Like, I don't want to see your face. All this stuff. And then he, like, crawls in beside her and you know, can't work up the courage to make love to her. Just not making love at that point.
That's not what that means. But he's honest with her. He says, "I haven't been with a woman in a long time," and that gives her reason to.
I know it's just that's the horrible part of it, because I think in today's day and age, we all know that that man's playbook of like
what's called the game, right?
The game, yeah. I'm gonna neg you as much as possible, and then I'm gonna show you a little bit of good stuff, and you're gonna love me for it. And so it's so clearly what he does, and it's done in a movie. And give credit to the writers of the book and the movie, because they did it without having the game around as like a rule book, right? They just knew that that's what that character would do. And so
– Well, he does that with everyone.
Yeah.
He doesn't – that's the thing about Baldwin's performance that's so great, is that he really doesn't care about anything. He doesn't even care about
himself.
He's
a psychopath.
He's a pure sociopath. He's just not interested in niceties, people who he depends on for help. He'll just insult them and shit on them constantly.
Yeah.
And it's just who he is. Mm-hmm. And it's not a good quality. I mean, that's how we know right away this guy's not to be trusted.
Yeah.
But the way he bulldozes people, again, with this practiced ease of doing this over and over again. He spent most of his life in prison, we're told, but I'm pretty sure every time he gets out, he does exactly this thing.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just, it's all habitual. Mm-hmm. And after a while, it becomes really clear, certainly on repeat viewings, there's nothing personal about it, which makes it worse.
For sure.
He's just a force that arrives in people's lives and ruins them.
Yeah.
It sort of reminds me of the deleted scenes in Bad Santa, not deleted scenes, the director's cut, where Billy Bob Thornton is essentially spending between one Christmas and the other just drifting through places and conning people and grifting things.
Yeah.
It's the exact same thing.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
He's like, he's a con man, but not smart about it. Like, it's almost like instinctual or compunctual, where he has to do it. It's not like he's doing this smartly and slyly and picking people's pockets or whatever.
He's right out in the open.
He does seem to have a bit of a code, because he doesn't really rob innocent people. He's not like he's not going to stick you up and take all your money.
That's what he says.
However, if he just happens to see you being stuck up, he does what a good Samaritan will do, help you out.
Mm-hmm.
But then he will take your wallet.
Exactly.
Yeah, he's like Robin Hood, but he doesn't give anything to the poor. I think that's how he puts it.
That's what he says, yeah.
And he sort of like Craigslist Joes himself up to like a bit of a fortune. Like, you know, start with the paperclip, trade it for something else. Yeah. He steals – well, he intervenes in a robbery, takes the person's wallet, and then uses that to buy a Uzi, a fake Uzi from a store, and then uses the squirt gun Uzi to rob somebody's car.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it also explains how he's been operating for so long, right? Because it's the definition of petty crime. If you're robbing other criminals, you're less likely to get reported. You're less likely to get noticed. It's the core of every Ocean's movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
You hit a guy who won't report it.
That's a good note. I'm going to write that down.
Oh, yeah. Now, if you ever get into criminality, this is the way to go.
Yes. Yeah, cool. Yeah.
And if you already have, there's plausible deniability.
This podcast is just a front for a criminal empire.
I assume that's how we make our money.
Yeah, we're laundering so much money through through podcasts. Oh, man.
Yeah.
Like and subscribe.
But we have more of the Jennifer Jason Leigh, Alec Baldwin relationship. They keep meeting up and sort of like strengthening their sort of thing.
Yeah, it's so – she goes over like head over tails, not for him, but to be with him, like to like him.
Yeah.
She really does some yoga to do that, like emotional yoga. She's like, I'm going to look past all of this. Yeah.
They're playing house with each other. I mean, that's ultimately – he wants to look like a solid citizen.
Yeah.
And she is more than happy to have a house, because it's what she wants. She's just fast-tracked to it. But you can always tell that the reservation is there, that she knows it can't possibly last. And it isn't until she's confronted with, you know, undeniable truth that it all comes crashing down. And right up until then, she's this sunny, supportive, happy person, or at least she's pretending to be.
Yeah. Well, and it's hard because at one point she does seem to be like getting what she wants, a house with him that he's renting from this old woman. And but at one point he's like, what do you want out of life? And she tells him and he's like, you're getting none of that. Like, it's just a blanket denial of everything she wants in her life. And it's after they've like been calling each other husband and wife and have gotten quote unquote married, which they didn't.
Yeah, they just say it. It's
they just real. Say it. Yeah. So I just felt so bad for her, and I wanted so. I was wondering where this movie was going because I think there are a lot of movies that show that, and the guy does something really like one thing redeeming at the very end, and you're supposed to like them, and then and I was so worried that was going to be this movie, and I was like, how am I going to talk about that?
It's not that kind of movie.
With Norm. Oh my god.
Not that kind of movie.
Yeah. So I'm glad it wasn't. I'm glad it wasn't. But let's. Yeah. Let's get there. Let's kind of.
Well, while they're playing house, that's when Hoke comes in and drops in for a visit to question them about the Hare Krishna incident at the airport.
A man in a suede sports coat was observed getting onto a hotel shuttle from the airport right after the incident, and that's what Hoke is following up on.
Yeah.
Meeting Junior, he knows instantly that it was him.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
then stays for dinner, which is such a great unexpected scene.
Yeah, this was the old days of police work where detectiving was mostly inviting yourself for dinner.
He does it repeatedly, which is sort of the most charming thing about Hoke mostly.
Yeah, yeah.
So, Harmon, what'd you do your time?
Time? What do you mean?
Oh, the way you're guarding that food. Not like another con could take it away from you.
I was raised in foster homes, you know. Didn't get no dessert till I was in the eighth grade.
No one's like, speak to my lawyer right away, or like, you can't enter my domicile. Like, no one really knows their rights. Everyone's being very cordial. It's like the 1950s.
Yeah. Well, if you don't admit to anything, you can probably get away with it. At least that's how it's played.
Yeah.
And then, again, because everybody recognizes the other people for who they are, you have this wonderful tension of Junior, like, basically jumping around the corner, miming, shooting Hoke with an actual gun, which got gasps in the theaters when I saw it. Both three times, I think. Every time, at least twice it happened. And people went, because it's shocking.
Yeah.
And it's funny.
Yeah.
But because Baldwin plays it on the balls of his feet, he just jumps in, does the thing, you know, pretends to blow smoke off the muzzle and then just pivots away. It's a great little moment. But it's shocking because this is the kind of movie that, 25 minutes in has already established this possibility. It's like, yeah, he could shoot him. And then what happens? This is, you know, a great kind of yes and aspect of the mystery is
Definitely.
There isn't any mystery to it. It's about what will happen, not about who knows what.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of the game that the movie is playing with us is this a redeemable guy? Like, is he the Robin Hood that he kind of purports to be, the selfish Robin Hood? Or is he someone that could blow someone away? And we find out the truth of that.
Who are we rooting for? Are we Hoke or are we Susie?
Yeah.
Right, in this movie. That's like, how are you responding to this story?
I like that. Yeah, yeah. That's great.
Yeah. I'm a Susie.
I would like to be a Susie.
Yeah.
Probably. I'm probably, I'm easily suckered.
Plus, Jennifer Jason Leigh's got it going on.
She does.
I mean,
well, she's,
creatively.
Creatively. Yeah. She's like, there's two women in this movie, and one of them is naked twice in this movie. I don't know. It felt kind of.
But she's not sexualized that way, right? There's one sex scene that is more conventional male gazey. The first time, it's really perfunctory. She's sort of bouncing around in her panties.
Yeah.
And I was surprised every time I see it. It's like, that's not. You know, there's no music telling you how to feel. There's no eroticism of it. It's really functional. She is a sex worker.
Right.
And she is getting ready because she's not physically interested, intimately, or emotionally tied to him yet. She is just doing her job. And it's a really weird shot. It's like a medium shot. It follows her around the bed. She just pulls her dress right over her head and gets to it. And it's then that he opens up to her and they start an actual relationship. And then the second time – there's a nude scene. It's both of them, and it's much more conventional. And it's just this weird little moment where you could have shot this a million different ways and almost all of them would have been familiar, recognizable, and conventionally eroticized. Like, mm-hmm. this is 1989 when they make this movie. There, all that stuff was happening.
Yeah.
A lot of exploitative stuff. Basic Instinct was a couple of years away, but they were like, the erotic thriller was already a thing.
Yeah, for sure.
And they just didn't do that. It's it's a great introduction for her because it tells you everything about who she is without making her an object. And, you know, like, as much as Junior wants her to be one,
right,
she won't be.
Yeah. Interesting. I do like the way the kind of camera plays with that too. At one point, she's changing out of her shirt and the camera pushes into Alec Baldwin so that we only see her from the shoulders up. And then the next scene, she's naked. So you're like, oh, God, okay. Like, well, you're really playing, like, toying with us as an audience. So it's interesting.
Wasn't for modesty.
No, it wasn't for modesty. Yeah.
No, but it puts us in his perspective for that moment where she's sort of shrouded. And the fact that, you know, he's hired her as a prostitute and she asks him to turn around is another great little moment because she's still being, you know, well, she's not being coquettish or anything. She's just – she's not ready yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, and she's a newly, you know, sanctioned prostitute, I guess.
We're assumed so. Yeah. I mean, she's 23. She's been – I suspect from the story that she tells people that she's 19.
Right.
I think she's been at this for a couple of years and she's practiced it. But
yeah. I mean, she does seem to be going through school on this too. I don't think she has any reason to lie at this point.
About the night classes? No, I think that's true.
Yeah, I think that's true as well. Yeah.
Her great plan is to open a Burger World franchise.
Yes.
Which is, you know, in 1989 and 1990, that's not a bad move.
It's a solid plan.
Yeah, and they can move
in
to Beyond
Florida?
Meat.
Are you kidding? There's a lot of people eating hamburgers in Florida.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, she would have been ahead of the Beyond Meat curve, I think.
Right? Yeah, she would have been good.
Yeah, probably. But after their dinner, Junior goes back to Hoke's place and beats the shit out of him.
Yeah, and steals his teeth.
And steals his
Poor
teeth.
Hoke.
His gun, his badge, and his teeth.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the badge, because he uses it immediately to intimidate a prostitute.
Mm-hmm. Well, and to do a bunch of other things like steal from people that are getting robbed and stop people from robbing a store and then steal what they were going to steal from the store.
Yeah.
So
it becomes his new shtick and he's in love with it. He loves all like the power and people love the badge.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, exactly. And there's this weird thing, too, that I thought was going to come up again, and it didn't quite, where he starts solving the cop's actual cases at one point. I was like, oh, is the cop and Junior actually going to become friends at the end of this? Is that where it's leading? There's all these things that I think movies now really tend to do, and this is bucking against that the entire time.
It's
so,
true. Yeah. Ever since Heat, I just want the cop and the criminal to be buds.
Yeah. I'm just like,
go
one
for
sit
coffee.
Down. Yeah. Have a drink.
You can work this out.
We're not so different, you and I.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Except they are. So, you know, that's great that the film never gives us that. That he's trying, but he's bad at it, or he's great at it by accident. And he has no skill. He shoots somebody in the Enstead's stop or I'll shoot, which is a great moment.
Yeah, for sure.
And only just through sheer stupidity does he ever get exposed. He pisses off the wrong people. He goes, he pushes too hard.
Yeah.
And in fact, the arrival very shortly after this segment of the film is that Paul Gleason shows up as the actual corrupt cop.
Right.
Who Hoke is now getting payments for because Junior busted up an operation and said, you're going to start sending half of this money to Hoke Mosley, which is his weird way of paying him for the gun and the badge because he says he never steals anything. He never takes anything he didn't pay for, which is also not true. But it's just one more rationalization. But it gives us that one magnificent scene with Paul Gleason where he shows up and just does the whole, you know, hang ten gesture and in this ridiculous white suit, and there's a whole other movie in his performance.
Definitely.
And I love that it intrudes into Miami Blues, and then we never see him again.
Yeah.
Just a corrupt cop revealing himself.
Like this Bad Lieutenant steps into this and steps out.
This would actually be another movie somewhere else where it would end with him getting revealed, but Hoke doesn't care. He doesn't know what's going on. Even when he's got the guy's money in his pocket, he's barely putting it together from moment to moment, and it's just this great difference in styles where you have a swaggering police lieutenant. You could get that story going. And Williford had him pop up, I think, at least once in another book. But he never had his own narrative because he's just too much of an idiot. He's just – he's too loud. You know, you go out in the world and you're exposed in minutes. Mm-hmm. And Hoke can just look at him and go, oh, this guy's an asshole.
Yeah.
And then get back to his own thing.
Yeah, and he is. I mean, Hoke is kind of like the Rocky of police detectives. He just like keeps on taking hits, and that's how he solves crimes. It seems like
Yes, that's right. If this guy beat me up, he's probably the suspect.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
I think about it. Yeah.
Occam's Fist.
Occam's Fist.
Math does check out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he goes after, yeah.
Yeah, but Junior just basically, his crime spree continues, and eventually it sort of catches up with him a bit. Like at one point he's at a convenience store,
mm-hmm.
and of course it just happens to get robbed while he's there, and he does his cop thing, but he tells the guy, like, you know, if you go now, then it's fine, you know, you don't have to, like, have this life of crime.
Right.
And the guy runs out the door and then drives his truck through the convenience store window and sort of, like, pins him down from the front.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, he's injured now.
Yeah.
He has to go home. He tries to get Jennifer Jason Leigh to sew up his eyebrow.
Which is a funny scene because they're both like trying not to puke as they have the needle thread.
Yeah. But that's love.
That's love.
Sure. You know,
yeah. He keeps her from passing out. She keeps him from passing out.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
And then neither of them is any good at it anyway. So, and here there's another kind of parallel with what Tarantino did with the ear in Reservoir Dogs, where there's just this shocking intrusion of gore to remind you what the stakes are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's funny mm-hmm. as opposed to horrific. And so, again, it's just another deviation that didn't take. If I still think this could have helped define another subgenre of noir storytelling, but then it just wasn't flashy enough to catch people's attention.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And it is gory. I mean, the makeup is so good because when the needle actually goes into that eyebrow, you see it, like, being attached again.
Yeah.
And the eyebrow is literally hanging off his face.
Prosthetic makeup.
Oh, it's so
much better than CGI. Just that little tug on the thread. It's just, again, the whole audience goes, feel it.
For sure.
Yeah. And then eventually the sort of, like, the big screw up he makes is he goes to a pawn shop and he's trying to shake down the owner for information about these coins, and she's not having any of it.
It's a crappy coin collection. He just happened to steal it from somebody else in Susie's building. Mm-hmm. And it's great. Again, someone else who sees right through him instantly knows, you know, like, really, you're a cop? What are you investigating? What's a homicide detective doing investigating a coin collection?
Yeah.
And she antagonizes him. He antagonizes her. Everything else goes to hell.
Well,
and his fingers get cut off.
Yeah, I think she wins because she definitely takes a machete and chops off three of his fingers.
Yeah.
What happened to your eye?
Car accident.
You should sue the doctor who sewed you up. You could make a bundle.
He said it'd be fine after it scarred over.
He lied. How come a homicide detective is so interested in stolen property?
First of all, that's confidential information. Second of all, I'll ask all the questions around here. I'm working on a tip. Thinking of putting a stake out in here.
He does shoot her.
Yeah, he does shoot her in the shoulder.
There
for
are
sure.
no winners in Miami Blues.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, Susie does okay.
and then Susie takes off because she's like, you lied to me. You said you were not going to do any crimes anymore. And she takes off.
Yeah.
He promised that
she was just taking him for errands, you know, just regular old stuff. And
to a pawn shop for errands. Yeah.
What? Sometimes some of us have to go to pawn shops, Blaine. Are you being judgy?
I'm not being judgy, man.
He said he had investments. I mean, this is technically that.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, and then she doesn't open the door for him, so he, you know, he's stuck there, and then Hoke comes after him, and
Hoke's been following them all along.
Yeah.
Because he had just met Susie at the Piggly Wiggly the day before with that wonderful, beautifully acted little moment between those two actors, between Fred Ward and Jennifer Jason Leigh.
That was a good scene.
Where he tells her the truth, and she crumbles and keeps going.
Yeah, she's good.
Yeah.
She's good in that scene.
Oh, yeah, and I forgot to talk about my favorite part of this movie, the vinegar pie.
Which is a thing.
Apparently.
Yeah.
I looked it up.
Oh, my Lord.
I mean, I thought it could be like one of those like Depression-era recipes, like, you know.
Yeah, tomato soup.
Probably where it came from.
Ketchup soup.
Ketchup soup, there you go.
Yeah. But she makes the vinegar pie, but she puts a lot of fucking vinegar in it.
I love that. The direction of that scene is not the best direction, I'm going to say, just because, like, I have been distracted and, like, tipped a little more over the measuring cup, you know? She dumps the whole bottle distracted. It goes all over her arm and hand, all over the counter. It's splashing on her. She's drowning in it and swimming, and she doesn't notice it.
It's
she
one of the
notices.
Best pie
she knows
scenes
exactly
in film
what
since
doing.
Labor Day.
Well, before, really.
Yeah.
No, American she knows pie, exactly what she's doing. It's a test of him.
Yeah.
She's giving him something terrible. And that moment when she cuts into it and there's a squeak sound as though it's going through air and mm-hmm. the crust is so hideous. It's just, again, it's a wonderful little moment that is not on the image. It's just on the soundtrack. But that awful puff of air sound that comes out, it's just, oh, it's going to be disgusting. And like, he eats it because that's his thing with her. He's, you know, the most important thing to her. He never hit me and he always ate everything I made for him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Low bar.
That's a low bar.
It is a low bar. but that speaks to her too. There's actually a lot of stuff about Susie that's cut from the film, which Ravindra, the Krishna is her brother. Which is sort of a larger thing about how they were fated to meet, but it's not important, so they left it out, which was exactly the right choice. Junior is a random force, makes absolutely more sense once you can see him instead of imagining him on the page. And Susie, like, they had escaped. They were basically Dust Bowl kids in the 70s. They had no money, dirt poor, and vinegar pie is something that actually is a pleasant memory for her, which she then destroys for Junior.
Right.
Man.
Yeah.
Poor Susie.
So it's a sad movie.
Poor Susie.
Yeah.
But she does. She does okay.
Well, yeah. She kind of gets off a little bit at the end because she's not – the cops like let her go. Let's not question her.
But she's also got the shoebox at the end, which is where all the money was.
Yeah.
And it seems like Coke has decided that that's okay too.
Yeah.
Most of it was taken from criminals anyway.
Right.
There's another little bit of a rationale going on.
I hope she opens that burger chain.
I think she's running four right now. She's got four burger worlds going.
Yeah, and because she survives, but the junior does not.
Yeah.
Hoke shoots him.
Yeah, he won't go willingly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's kind of like death by cop.
Suicide by cop. Probably planned it that way somehow and in some level. He wants it to be over.
Mm-hmm.
Most of his fingers have been cut off. And
yeah. Once you're missing three fingers – actually, I shouldn't say that. My grandpa was missing at least three fingers.
Oh, really?
And he lived a full life, Mr. Alec Baldwin.
Stealing from other cops and criminals?
Maybe.
Yeah. Take it to the grave.
Two-fingered Jimmy. Well, that is the kind of rundown of this movie. We'll be back in just a second to talk about some trivia, some behind the scenes. And I think, Norm, you're going to know all this trivia.
I'm old.
We'll see.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to Rewatchability. We're talking about Miami Blues with Norm Willner. And I have some trivia for you guys right here. Jennifer Jason Leigh plays Alec Baldwin's love interest in this film. But in what film does she play William Baldwin's love interest?
I was actually going to mention that by comparison to the whole sex scene thing.
It's the first question, so it's
I
a little
just jump
easy.
In
yeah,
and
yeah,
answer
please.
This? Yeah, Backdraft.
Backdraft.
Where their love scene is both embarrassing and eroticized on top of a fire truck.
For sure.
And we don't like to talk about that movie.
We talked about Backdraft not too long ago.
Oh, there's so many good parts of Backdraft.
It's weird. It's so 90s. It kind of holds up as an example of what they were doing, and it kind of also is embarrassing and unwatchable from shot to shot.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Can I ask you, Norm?
And the Red Dragon stuff is just bizarre, right? Like the fact that they lifted the entire plot with Robert De Niro and Donald Sutherland from Red Dragon and Manhunter, whatever you want to call it.
I didn't realize.
He's Firebug Lecter.
Yeah.
It's bizarre that it's almost – there's a scene where he talks about – you know, oh, you love this, don't you? Oh,
yeah.
Well, you know. And it's like, I just saw that movie. Sorry, you were going
to
say.
Well, I wanted to know because, I mean, you were a little bit older than us. You were around during peak Baldwin.
Yes. They were everywhere.
Was there ever like a competition between – like a serious competition
like
where it wasn't like
Baldwin,
Alec Baldwin's going to
Baldwin.
Be the good one and the rest of them are going to be like, you know
– Everybody knew that Alec was the most talented one.
Mm-hmm.
And then – Daniel just got weird really fast.
Mm-hmm.
I remember his roles just got stranger and thicker. Steven, he's the one in The Usual Suspects, so he had his moment.
Right.
And then he just made a lot of direct-to-video stuff that nobody cared about. And then Billy William Baldwin was harder to pinhole because he was the one – like Alec was going to be a matinee idol, big movie star.
Right.
And then he didn't – he just changed his mind and he didn't do the second Jack Ryan movie.
Mm-hmm.
After Red October, and he sort of torpedoed his entire career as an action star, which I think for him was the right move because he's way more interesting as whatever it is he turns into in the 90s and the 2000s.
Yes.
And Billy Baldwin kind of stepped in to fill the void, but he's a much more limited actor. So I think Alec was always like Baldwin prime, and then after that they were fighting on the pyramid to see who got the second and third, the peripheral Baldwins.
That's tough.
I forget which one is making all the Left Behind movies.
Oh, that's Steven.
Is it Steven?
Yeah, he's the hyper-Christian weirdo one.
That's unfortunate. I guess it's one in four. I guess that makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know.
Fair enough. Okay, second question. Fred Ward bought the rights to this book so he could make the leap from supporting man to main actor, although he was in Tremors as kind of a main character. So he had his eyes on the junior role. Whom did he try to cast as Hank Mosley at first?
Oh, yeah. Gene Hackman.
I did
know that for a second. It's like, oh, wait a minute. No, it is. It was Hackman. And Hackman would have been great.
Hackman would have been great.
Yeah. Already old enough.
Yeah.
Like slow enough. He could play it. Like Unforgiven was still a couple of years away, so he wasn't anywhere near done with acting.
Yeah.
But yeah, I could have seen it. But Hackman played a lot of private eyes, were kind of adjacent characters.
Yeah.
I mean, there's the conversation, obviously. But
yeah.
There's a bunch of other stuff he did in the 60s and 70s where he sort of fit in. And I can see him just not wanting to do that.
Yeah, but this – it feels like he got to play a little bit more comedy in this. Like, and he was, you know, kind of funny as Lex Luthor and like all this stuff.
I felt like he could have done this
role so well.
I wonder if he didn't want to look weak because this is the book where Hulk is kind of on the back foot for the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah. Fair enough.
I'm not doing the teeth thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Keeping him. I wonder if Fred Ward would not have worked as Junior Franger. He was too old.
Yeah.
Like already.
He wouldn't have worked as Junior.
Oh, yeah.
Certainly not with the Susie they got.
Yeah, no, not with the Susie. Yeah. That would have been bad.
Yeah, but picking an unknown, like a relatively unknown quantity like Alec Baldwin, who was in, I think, three or four movies at that point.
And
like she's having a baby.
Pretty Boy, too.
And Beetlejuice, where he's more of a like a leading man
rather
than someone with darkness to him.
Mm-hmm.
Married to the Mob has that, but he's also like he's killed in the first 20 minutes, so he doesn't really get to show any real criminality. Yeah, no, this was a revelatory performance from him. He looks so striking. He's physically so interesting when just watching him move through
he's
scenes.
He's so chaotic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's a chaos demon.
Yeah.
Manic. His eyes are crazy.
Yeah.
He has crazy eyes.
Well, the blue – it's the Katy Perry thing, right? Like the blue eyes and the dark coloring. It's just
– Yes. Katy Perry could have also worked in this role.
Katy Perry could play. I would like to see a remake.
Miami Blues with Katy Perry.
She would have done great. Okay.
Why does Katy Perry spring to mind for that contrast? Like Zooey Deschanel has it too. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
Because Katy Perry seems like a psychopath.
How
and
dare
Zooey
you?
Zooey Deschanel can do no wrong.
How dare you?
I'm going to defer to you guys on that one.
All right. So there is a famous filmmaker that unites both. That's kind of like one person away from Demme, the producer of this movie, Armitage, the director, and the author of the book, Charles Williford, as well. So what famous filmmaker kind of worked with all three of them?
Well, it's Corman.
You got
– Yeah, I mean, we've already mentioned him.
Yeah. Right, you got to do better than that, Blake.
Roger,
that's embarrassing.
It was so hard to find trivia.
Roger Corman basically is the glue that creates the American – cinema of the 80s and 90s.
Yeah. Churned out so many famous filmmakers.
Yeah, people would just work for him and then graduate.
Mm-hmm.
And Armitage and Demme both worked. Like Demme was I think he made three films for him.
Mm-hmm.
I think – and yeah, Demme made Chained Heat famously. He never made a nurse movie, but I'm sure that's how Armitage and Demme met. Like some story conference over who could use this actor or that actor in a given week.
Yeah.
And you know, he launched Coppola. De Palma owes him favors. There's all sorts of footprints that lead back to Corman
in
cinema.
Sure.
And Miami Blues feels like a Corman movie too. Mm-hmm. It has a looseness. It has the locations look like locations. Like they didn't get permits. They just showed up and started shooting the exterior.
Sure.
There's the laziest gunfight in the world at the very end, which is just great because the camera seems to be racing to catch up where the bullets go.
Yeah.
There's they shoot at a car window at one point. And it's like, I think it shatters or maybe you just hear it, but it doesn't matter. It adds
like a cat
to it.
In the background.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just, they slap it together and it somehow feels authentic that way.
Yeah, for sure. Do you know how the author, Charles Wilford, knows Corman?
No, I assume they wrote. He wrote on something, but that
he didn't write. It wasn't a writing thing. He acted in a Corman movie.
Which one?
The Corman produced movie called Thunder and Lightning. Yeah, he played a bartender.
I don't know that.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, well, it's a it's a deep cut. So
where was that when you were asking trivia questions?
Well, there's part of the trivia question. How did the three? Anyway, so but it's kind of cool that I read up on Charles Willford, and it was really interesting. He had like a crazy life, this author. His mom and brother died of TB by the time he was 10. At 13, he assumed like another person's identity and like rode the rails between Mexico and U.S.
Oh, no, Whitman somebody?
Yeah, he Dick Whitman somebody. Then he enlisted in the army at 16 because the ID said he was way older. He said it was like 7 years older than he actually was, which is crazy. He must have looked so old. And then he was in a tank in the Battle of the Bulge. He has a Purple Heart, Silver and Bronze Cross. It's insane what he did. And then after he left the army, he wrote a bit while he was still in the army. And then he was a boxer, an actor, a horse trainer, a radio announcer, and
he was a shitty horse trainer, let's be honest.
Just shot in the air. But
what if that was the best thing he ever did?
Yeah, that's how he thought
it's
of
like
himself.
One and done. Let's go. I'm moving
that
on.
That horse was broken.
Yeah, I've written books. Yes. But my real, real prize is
teaching a horse to write books.
Yeah, exactly.
Vinegar Pie. That's the name of the horse.
And he also studied art history in Lima, Peru, as like he was going to be a PhD. That was his PhD. But then he was kicked out because he falsified all his papers to say that he had a bachelor and master's degree.
Damn.
So he was just – I feel like learning about him, I learned a little bit about Junior.
Yeah. He's like a more benevolent Junior.
He is. He's a little nice. He was married three times, so we'll see how benevolent he was when we talked to his first two wives. But yeah, he grifted through life a little bit. And yeah.
That's why books are boring these days, because the authors didn't have sketchy con man lives.
They have to imagine the sketchy con man life and then fake the book and call it an autobiography, and everybody's disappointed when they find out it's not true. Yeah.
Yeah. Shatters into a million little pieces.
I don't know if I don't know if he ever wrote an autobiography, but I'd love to read it.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. Yeah. I couldn't find one, but
yeah,
it'd be
I
great
only
if,
know him through the novels.
Yeah, yeah. So a bit of behind the scenes on this, just how it got made. It was Fred Ward bought the book for $4,000, and then he brought it to Demme and was like, "You need to direct this because you direct great movies, and I need to be in that." And Demme was like, "No, not at all." But my friend hasn't worked in 13 years, man. Armitage, yeah.
Sterling endorsement.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Check out his nurse movie. You'll see.
Yeah. Well, because he hadn't made anything after those movies, and Hollywood kind of shut him out. And Demme blamed it on the fact that Armitage wasn't like a schmoozer and wasn't, hip in with the Hollywood scene. But in that time, Armitage wrote 50 scripts and tried to sell them to like 50 Whoa. In 10 years. Like, that's so many scripts.
Yeah.
I can't imagine writing 5 scripts a year and then keep on putting them out and be like, will anyone buy this? Nope. Next one. Like, that's insane to me. So it's cool that he did it and cool that he finally got a break in this movie and then went on to make Gross Point Blank,
right.
Which is one of my favorite films.
Yeah.
So
yeah, and one of the films that actually picks up on the Reservoir Dogs Pulp Fiction thing by being a new iteration of whatever the Tarantino thing was, the neo-noir wave that way. He followed in that case, like he didn't follow his own direction. He went with the other guy and made one of the best versions of it.
Well, I feel like he's close to Junior. Like he could do anything and he doesn't know what he wants to do.
Yeah,
like
just emulate
I think,
it.
Yeah, writing 50 scripts, I feel like you don't have a direction.
Yeah,
one of them
did get made. There's this utterly forgotten movie called The Last of the Finest.
Okay.
Bill, I want to say Bill Paxton's the lead in that.
Ooh.
It's a bunch of cops chasing drug dealers in 1991, 1992.
Okay.
Absolutely. It was made because Miami Blues was with
Ryan.
He sold them another thing.
Yeah.
He didn't direct it, and it is just totally forgotten and forgettable. Like it would be a direct-to-video movie now.
Okay.
Or a Netflix movie probably. It's not bad, but it is absolutely generic.
Right.
And nothing – there are no surprises. The villain's a drug dealer. The cops are all, you know, like a loose family that argues with everybody. And then a few years later, Heat comes along and shows you what that can be.
Sure. Yeah,
so this is one of those movies that isn't Heat.
Sure.
But he finally sold the script, so there's that.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
That's good, Armitage.
Yeah, and Gross Point Blank is amazing. I'm sure more people know that than Miami Blues.
Yeah,
it's only 7 years later.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And even making this movie, he had a hard time because he was about to be fired off the movie, and Demi had to step in as producer.
Yeah, Demi was his bodyguard, basically.
Yeah, yeah, basically just to keep him in the business. And Fred Ward was a producer on it because he bought the rights, and then he had a kind of interesting life too. His father was in jail on the day of his birth because his father was like a anti-law criminal. He was a criminal guy, and so he
I've heard of those.
Yeah, exactly. And then he was a drifter too. Like he drifted around the states. And his
Fred Ward.
Yeah,
Fred Ward looks like he was.
Yeah, a drifter.
Yeah, yeah.
I buy it.
And then he wound up in San Francisco, originating roles in Sam Shepard plays. Like he just his nice. Start was like
That's how he got onto the right stuff. Right, Shepard brought him along.
Yeah, yeah, and it's just like his. His career was like one thing, and then the next he was like in movies. You're like, how? That's crazy,
yeah,
Fred Ward.
That was the 70s, man.
Yeah.
You could trip into a movie.
Right, exactly. It's so much harder now, man. And Jennifer Jason Leigh, I looked into her, and I was like, oh, maybe she has a crazy past, too. Her dad's an actor, and her mother's a writer. So I was like, you were born for the cinema. Yeah.
Well, her dad was killed on the Twilight Zone set. There's your crazy story.
Yeah,
that's
true.
A trauma that she's kind of never really...
Yeah.
Reckon with publicly, as I understand it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it would be hard to reckon with publicly.
But I mean,
can you imagine being the interviewer being like, let's talk about Vic Morra.
For all the coverage of it, though, and there, you know, there's a lawsuit, there was this, there's a book written about that, and she's a ghost in it. She really doesn't appear. And I think that's the way, like, I can't conceive of someone doing that now when everybody is that intrusive and invasive. But the idea that she could just sort of pull herself back and then create her own career separate from that is pretty admirable for the somebody in the late 80s.
For sure.
And her mom wrote Georgia for her.
Yeah, she starred in one of his mom's films.
Yeah, one of her best known roles or one of her most intense performances.
For sure.
She's clearly still committed to doing the best thing, the best version of whatever it is she does. And people who saw her in this for the first time would have had no idea how to process it. Although I guess by then she was already pretty well known for Fast Times at Ridgemont High and stuff like that.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. Cool. Yeah.
But it felt like a revelation. It felt like a new person showing up.
Yeah, well, she's great in this movie. And I think the – for me, I think we're going to go around and talk about kind of if this was rewatchable for us. And Rob and I,
I'd love to know how you processed it.
But yeah, I think for me it was – The elements were there, but like I said at the beginning, there wasn't that much style to it, and it felt like it was begging for it at times. Like it wanted something to come along and show us what to look at instead of just bullets flying into the air and
just
being
the observational
thing. And I think the acting is well done. Alec Baldwin is literally an insane man in this movie.
Oh my god.
I'm kind of scared of him.
He's so manic.
And Jennifer Jason Leigh is really great. And Fred Ward is, he gives those touches. He like elevates it. And that's really great. But I don't, for me, the elements didn't really come together. One of the big things in this movie's bonnet, I'd say, is its surprise. It like surprised me a lot. Like when he lets the guy go and the guy gets in the car, I'm like, well, that guy is going to drive off into the – oh, he just ran him over.
And I don't even think it's intentional. I think he's just a terrible criminal. Like, I don't think he put his car into drive on purpose.
For sure.
He's just bad at everything. You can see him shaking and nervous and he's got a limp that we never understand and pointing the gun. I don't think he has two lines of dialogue.
No.
He's just kind of flailing around. So of course that would happen.
Yeah.
But when it happens, it's shocking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, but it's organic to the story and And the other thing, I think there's just the through line of Alec Baldwin's character is hard for me because at one point he says, I don't know what I want. And that's so hard to write a character that doesn't know what they want at all.
Yeah.
What are they trying to do from scene to scene? And so every scene seems like a scene that is starting a character almost where he's in the
– Who is he now?
Who is he now? Yeah. Every scene is an introduction scene to him. And so it's like in the story he's like, leave. You don't have to have a life of crime. You're like, okay. That's different from the guy who we had three scenes ago who was like holding someone up. So And then he's kind of backfilled later where he's like, well, I was trying to be a good guy. Yeah.
But I also think he sees his younger self. Like there must have been a version of Junior who didn't know what he was doing.
Right.
And maybe in this moment, because he's playing a cop,
yeah,
he's acting out some kind of weird trauma of his younger self and giving that guy the chance he never had.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's left to us to kind of dig through like chaotic character to come out with reasons. And maybe that's the brilliance of it, that we're kind of Jennifer Jason Leigh's character being like, who are you?
Yeah. And how much danger am I in from moment to moment?
Exactly. And how can I like you and all that stuff? And I think there's a rash of likable people wanting likable characters because of that 22 Pixar rules theory of screenwriting where your character has to do something that saves the cat and is likable. And so every producer I talk to now is like, this person has to be likable. They're not that likable. And it's like, well, the world isn't full of likable people and you can center on someone who's not likable.
Yeah. I think of all the Tarantino films inevitably will have – not the Tarantino films, but the wave that started with Reservoir Dogs, all of those movies that came out in the 90s, they were always about well-spoken people with inner lives doing awful things. And you were on their side. You want to empathize with them. You want to sympathize with them. Miami Blues doesn't give you that because Hoke is supposed to be our focal character, but really it's Susie because of the way the movie shoots it.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, Alec Baldwin gets to be this massive, invasive, disturbing force that just shows up and annoys people and threatens them and shoots them and kills them.
Yeah.
And then leaves and gets to go and do it again. So that's exactly how you're supposed to respond to it. And you're like, why is he here? Why am I watching this? And the answer is because of the effect he has on the people around him, which is the thing that I always come back to.
Mm-hmm.
It's an amazing performance because let's see. There's a movie called The Iceman with Michael Shannon from about 6 or 7 years ago.
I remember the poster. Yeah.
Not a very good movie.
Okay.
But he plays a guy named, I want to say, Richard Kolinsky, who was a serial killer. He admitted to – or he claimed to have murdered dozens and dozens of people as a mob hitman.
Right.
And it's based on a videotape of an interview with this guy, which was called Interview with the Assassin, where he just – this testimonial, like a true crime video of a guy talking to camera about all the people he's killed. And there is nothing to this guy. He just sits still and he talks.
Right.
And it's dead-eyed and cold and scared.
Sure. He's like a neutral mask kind of thing.
Yeah. He's finally unburdening himself, but it was never a burden.
Right.
It's a laundry list.
Sure.
And then I did this and then I did this. And Shannon's way of performing that, of portraying it in the moment, was to give nothing back to his co-stars.
Right.
Anybody in the scene with him, he just glared at them. And he's Michael a big Shannon's physically so good. Guy.
Yeah.
He's a big guy. And he would just physically and emotionally intimidate them.
Sure.
And it's an incredible performance in a movie that doesn't deserve it because everybody else is like, well, but he's the hero, so we kind of have to like him.
Right.
It's like, no, he's not going to let you. And Baldwin is doing something very similar in that he finds a core of anger in Junior. Like he's impatient. He just wants to be done with whatever's happening so he can go to his next thing or so he can take the thing he wants to take.
Yeah.
And watching that come out in the conversations with someone who he's supposed to be in love with is painful. And in the scenes with Hoke, it's like he's just bristling with violence because all he wants to do is kill him. But he can't because that's the wrong move. And so you're watching a guy who knows – maybe he doesn't know what he wants, but he knows what he shouldn't do.
Mm-hmm.
And he's doing it over and over again. And I just found that absolutely fascinating.
Interesting. Well, what about you, Rob?
Yeah, I mean, I think like what you said, this movie is the deviation from the Tarantino stylized, aestheticized crime movie.
Yeah, it's the alternate history. It's where it could have gone.
And it's been like – we've had like probably like 30 years of crime movies being like that. And so I think like the hardest thing for me watching this movie is just that it seems like such a throwback to an older style of movie. It's like the kind of cop show or the kind of cop movie that my stepdad watched. And
yeah.
I think that's something that should totally be explored now since we played, you know, the cool crime, suave criminal to death. Now that that's been done a bazillion times, you know, I think the other style might be really interesting to look at. But watching it as an experience for the first time, I found myself like struggling to like get hold of it and try to figure out like – what am I supposed to be – who am I supposed to be rooting for? What am I supposed to be rooting for? What's Alec Baldwin's deal? Why doesn't Jennifer Jason Leigh stand up to him. And of course, there's like lots of good reasons for that. But as a viewing experience, it wasn't super pleasant for me. However, I think having talked about it with you and sort of having thought about it and done some research after I watched it, I can definitely see what they were going for. And I think it is – I like that it is willing to show like, you know, an unglamorized sort of aspect of criminality. I like the whole sort of like throwback to noir style plotting. Mm-hmm. I think it's all – I think it all sort of like does interesting stuff. But for me – I don't feel like I have enough of the vocabulary to put it together in, you know, at least on the first viewing. I think if I watched it again, which I might do, I think I could definitely appreciate some of the nuances in the relationships and mm-hmm. all that stuff. But yeah, it was so hard to like Alec Baldwin because I just felt so much like sympathy for Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Yeah.
And I'm just, there's so many movies, I guess, I've seen recently where like, you know, men are psychopathic dicks to women. And that doesn't, you know, I think that this movie does it really well. Like it, you know, it shows us exactly what he's doing. It shows us exactly why Jennifer Jason Leigh isn't able to sort of confront him about it. But for me, it wasn't like a fun watch. So I'm going to say on the not rewatchable side.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, Norm.
No, that's fine. I rewatched it. I'm happy. this is the second time I've watched it in a few months, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah. A friend of mine had never seen it.
And
I demanded he watch it.
Yeah.
He liked it.
Well, he was sitting right beside you. Yeah. I feel like it's
I'm
hard
not
a, to...
I'm not an intimidating viewing partner. I sit very quietly. Okay. I have my cookies. I'm fine. I don't bother anybody. But it is funny. My wife had never seen it, and we watched it just four nights ago, and she did not like it.
Yeah.
She was not into the power dynamics, the relationships, and she thought that Jennifer Jason Leigh was too much of a or that Susie specifically was too much of a doormat. Yeah. And I can see where she's coming from, but I think if you miss the – and at the risk of mansplaining it, if you miss the fact that Susie is terrified of him the minute they meet, then nothing else follows.
Right.
And so maybe that's something that doesn't show up on first viewing not easily. I mean, I've seen this – I can't count how many times I've seen it. I may be the reason it's on Blu-ray, which I'm very proud of. When Shout Factory started, I got to know the one of the people who runs it, Tom Chen, professionally. I mean, we would just run into each other because I was one of the only people writing about those movies that they were releasing. And gradually he would start saying, oh, we have this catalog. Is there anything in here? And
then that's interesting.
They got the Canal Plug, Studio Canal catalog, I want to say 6 or 7 years ago. And then there was a second bump of stuff from MGM and I realized Miami Blues was in there and I just sent him an email with Miami Blues all in caps. Wow. And a year and a half later, here it is.
And a toy Uzi.
I wish
like, put it in there.
Shown up.
Yeah, exactly.
Thought about it, but if that's the one thing I do as a film archivist, and I'm pretty happy going down
good
on this
legacy.
One.
That's great.
It's a good. It's a small legacy, but it's a good one.
That's awesome. For people that want to check out your podcast, that is, obviously like more in depth into movies, and I mean,
it's about the same as this experience, frankly. I mean, excuse me. Yeah, it's called Someone Else's Movie. It's a show where I talk to a writer, director, an actor, or industry figure about a movie that they love, but that they didn't make. Mm-hmm. So it can't be promotional.
Yep.
I mean, it can obviously, but the point of it is an advocacy show for people to talk about a movie that maybe influenced them or that they just saw and can't stop thinking about.
Yeah.
And that can be kind of fun.
Yeah,
it's on the Frequency Podcast Network. You can find it on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, wherever you found this show. It'll be there, stalking it.
And what the what episode? You have an episode that you like in the last little while?
The platonic ideal of the show is the one I did a few years ago with Sarah Gadon on Cleo from 5 to 7.
Oh, nice.
Agnes Varda's first feature in a movie that is as much about female beauty and self-image as any movie is. Mm-hmm. And Sarah Gadon, who at the time had just come off a film called Antiviral, which was very much about her creating a campaign for her character, who's a model and an actor, and she's always had this really interesting relationship with her own image. Mm-hmm. It was just, and she went to film school, so she was just prepared,
right?
And she showed up and just that's probably the most intellectually engaged anybody has ever been on that show, and it's fantastic.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
that's...
and also there's one with Tatiana Maslany and her partner Tom Cullen. They wanted to do There Will Be Blood, and I was worried because these are incredible, talented, powerhouse actors, and within 10 minutes we were all high on sugar and just doing Daniel Day-Lewis voices at each other. So that was a blast.
Good. Well, I'll listen to both of those. That sounds great.
Oh, you should.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Oh,
it was a
pleasure.
Joy to have you.
No, this is great. Thanks for having me, and thanks for letting me spread the gospel of Miami Blues to whoever wants it.
Like kind of like a podmash, you know? Like you come on, advocate for one of your movies.
Yeah, that, it's kind of weird. I end up in the opposite seat, but it's fun. I like being the advocate.
Yeah. It's good. It's a good position to be in. So thanks for coming on. And you listeners, you can find us at Apple Podcasts and you can rate us there. And if you don't have any money to go to patreon.com/rewatchability, then you can just
steal some. Preferably from
bad
somebody
people.
Stealing something
from bad
already.
People.
If you
want to
keep
a moral judgment.
All your fingers, then you can then you can just tell someone about the podcast because we really appreciate that. Or you can go on Twitter or Facebook and talk to us because we always love talking to you. So thank you so much for joining us, and we'll talk to you next week.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.